It's incredible archive of priceless photos and documents being preserved and made accessible both in person and online from a location in Burien. And it's the result of a unique partnership between five nonprofit groups devoted to Northwest Railroad history. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell took a trip to the Pacific Northwest Railroad Archive. Felix is brought to you by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Hi, Felix.
Yeah, morning, Dave. Yeah, this is a pretty cool organization that dates back a little more than a decade. I've been planning a visit since before the pandemic, and I finally made it there a few days ago to their facility in Burien. You know, in the past year or so, the publicly owned National Archives in Seattle and the State Archives in Olympia have gotten a lot of attention. But there's this whole ecology of private groups who do so much to preserve and share the raw materials of history. You know, we've talked before on this show about groups like the Puget Sound Maritime Historical Society or the Black Heritage Society who do this sort of work, of course. But there's something about trains and railroad history that's almost universally appealing and that's a little tough to explain. And so at the Pacific Northwest Railroad Archive the other day, I asked Board President Bob Kelly why it is that so many people have an obsession with old locomotives or old railroad stations.
I don't know, but I certainly have it, you know. If I could stop and see a train go by, I will stop and see a train go by, or I will go to the depot, and I can't tell you what kind of locomotive it is, and I can't tell you what kind of air pump it has or any of that, like a lot of people can.
Yeah.
But there's this feeling about it that a lot of us have. It's like, whoa, boys, I'm in the right place.
Now, Bob's a great northern guy. We'll talk about what that means in a few minutes. The founder and director emeritus of the Pacific Northwest Railroad Archive is Gary Tarbox. He's a Northern Pacific guy. He's also had a 40-year career in tech at Boeing and Microsoft. He's the architect of the partnership between the five groups that form the archive: Cascade Rail Foundation, Great Northern Railway Historical Society, Northern Pacific Railway Historical Association, Spokane, Portland, and Seattle Railway Historical Society, and the Boeing Employees Model Railroad Club.
We are a consortium of five different organizations, all doing something that no one of them could do alone. In other words, we've pooled our resources to do something that's way above what any one organization can really finance and all.
You know, and it's really unusual and a really brilliant way to kind of kill a bunch of birds with one stone. And the best thing they did was to buy an old plumbing supply building in Burien back in 2010 when the real estate market was still reeling from the Great Recession. You know, it's critical for any archive to know it will never have to move. You know, just ask the people out at Sand Point about
right.
that. Now, the Burien facility is open only by appointment. They've got about a dozen workstations for in-person access, but they're also very active by email and phone for people all over the country, and they've spent a lot of time digitizing stuff. In the storage areas, which are pretty massive, they have old ledgers and maps, railroad timetables, thousands and thousands of photos. You know, much of it's organized in what's called compact storage. Those are those kind of shelves that you can wheel
right.
with a crank and move back
wheels
and forth across the floor to make space. And before this archive existed, most of this stuff was spread out amongst countless private basements around the region. It was really just like a diaspora. Now, I talked to a researcher over on the east side named Kent Sullivan, who does a lot of work on Northern Pacific history, like that old Beltline, which is where the new East Rail runs through Kirkland and Bellevue. Now, Kent really appreciates the volume and quality of material at the Pacific Northwest Railroad Archive and the staff and volunteers.
Having a place that has a critical mass of material now, it doesn't mean that there's no searching and scratching your head and trying to figure out where to look, but at least you have some confidence that if there is an answer, it's likely to be in that building and that there's a staff, some paid, mostly volunteers, who are constantly paying attention to that collection, doing an inventory, trying to get it organized, cross-reference, get it digitized. It's just an enormous help.
I also talked to Gus Malonis. He's a third-generation Northwest Railroad guy who recently retired from BNSF Railway after a long career and who was heard often on local media. BNSF has supported the archive financially. They appreciate that the consortium exists and that they're taking Northwest Railroad history seriously, and it's a resource for BNSF, too.
When I was director of public affairs, I might get a call on a circus train, and I'd need information on, well, what type of rail cars were used to transport elephants, or information about an old train station that no longer exists. The train stations are disappearing. An old depot somewhere. They were great help.
You know, and that's the thing about railroad history. It goes far beyond just nostalgia for steam engines. I mean, the railroads were one of the earliest heavy industries, earliest major landowners around here back in the 1870s. So railroad history, it's like this hidden superstructure underpinning so much of the other, you know, post-settlement history. You know, Board President Bob Kelly told me how the archive recently helped a surveyor in the Chehalis area.
He was surveying some property and nothing lined up. And so he contacted us because the survey started in the middle of the railroad, except the railroad it started from was in where the railroad was located in 1890, not where the railroad was today. So his crew had gone out to where the railroad was today. As soon as we showed him where the railroad was in 1890, all of a sudden everything lined up.
And I mentioned Bob Kelly's a great northern guy. Gary Tarbox is a Northern Pacific guy. I found that in any Northwest Railroad history gathering or conversation, each railroad history buff will have one favorite railroad they cherish above all others. Great Northern, Northern Pacific, Milwaukee Road. They don't hate the others, but they do love their favorite. You know, and most of those railroads were ultimately folded into what's now BNSF. The big merger was more than 50 years ago. And Director Emeritus Gary Tarbox says the specific date forms a kind of a dividing line between eras. It also informs the larger philosophy for the folks at the archive.
We tend to do March 2nd of 1970 as the last day of the independent railroads, the Great Northern and the Northern Pacific, and, because they all went into the Burlington Northern from our perspective here. So that's we consider that merger day. But post-merger, we still follow the rails. You know, where it went, how communities were served. A lot of cases here is not so much we're focusing on the railroads, but we're focusing on the communities served by the railroads.
And that's the key right there. You know, railroad history is really just history. And with this archive, the best place to start is our website, pnrarchive.org. They have thousands and thousands of items online. It's not just for specialists. It's for anyone who's interested in really anything about Northwest history.
Yeah. I had a fascination with trains, too, as a kid. I had a model railroad set. Do they have a model railroad set at the museum, by the way?
They do. That's one of the groups is the Boeing Employees Model Railroad Club. And in a big room, they show me there's this huge layout, bigger than anyone I've ever seen, with meticulous detail of these little tiny railroad engines and depots and little tiny people and mountain goats up in the hills. It's crazy. They have open houses for that on occasion.
That's good, because even if you're not into old documents, everybody loves a good railroad set, right?
Isn't that weird? It's so funny.
Felix Bunnell is our resident historian. You can find all his features, fully illustrated, by the way, at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. As the Seattle City Council budget season gets underway, the first of three public hearings was held last night, dedicated to hearing just how the public wants the city to spend its money. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott with the highlights. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, good morning, Dave. Yes, one of the big highlights, something we haven't heard a lot about in recent months, with focus being so much on public safety and housing, was climate change.
The mayor's proposed 2022 budget, which cuts $100 million from the Amazon tax funds for affordable housing and Green New Deal projects, is completely unacceptable in the context of rapidly rising rents and looming climate disaster.
As we make investments in climate resilience through the Green New Deal and more sustainable housing, we need to provide more opportunities for women and people of color in these trades that provide middle-class wages and benefits.
In support of the people's budget and in solidarity with the solidarity budget, I'm asking you to increase the Amazon tax by $120 million to extend funds for affordable housing and the Green New Deal project, including urgent building and home weatherization.
I'm a little emotional today because I'm in mourning, but I'm not alone. My entire generation is grieving. This is why we grieve, climate change. Everything has been taken from us. Our childhoods are gone. My futures are uncertain.
So pretty powerful.
There's
stuff.
Serious distress there.
Yes, yes. And there was many, many more. This was, I should say, more than 200 people, I think, signed up for comment. They got through about 185. It was a 3.5-hour meeting that wrapped up about 9:30 last night. And it's one of three, so there will be a couple more of these for folks who want to weigh in on everything that they want. The mayor has proposed her budget, and now starting this morning, the city council will start going through what they call issues identification, with things they want to change, and that'll take several weeks as they move through that process. So you heard a lot about the Green New Deal and climate change and various things like that. Some other highlights include some of the norms, housing and transit, actually.
I'm calling today, again, in support of the solidarity budget, especially considering it is the best way to address our housing crisis. And on a personal level, I am especially interested in its investment in our transportation budget as a primarily pedestrian transit rider and former biker and want to be future biker. I would like to be able to get around my city without fear of being hit.
I'm urging council members to add more funding to the budget for affordable housing and homelessness and to reinstate the Jumpstart program and spending more affordable money on affordable housing. In addition to funds for 3 more tiny home villages next year.
The mayor's budget falls short of the $60 million needed for participatory budgeting, and there is no mention of a community-led program such as Cahoots or STAR that have been extremely successful. This is a huge gap in the city's public safety plan and continues to leave Seattle residents experiencing mental health crisis without services. The addition of 35 sworn officers is heading us in the wrong direction.
So you heard a lot of what she said there at the end against putting any more money towards police. I believe the mayor's budget mm-hmm. had funding for like 125 cops, which was a net plus of 35. We did also hear, remember where I had the letter from the Downtown Seattle Association that had about 40 businesses and locals who had signed on to it that we talked about last week. That has now been signed by more than 150 groups, businesses, residents, and individuals. So you did see some representation on that front last night.
Before COVID, downtown businesses were closing at an alarming rate. COVID and efforts to defund the police have accelerated the problem. Many of us are rethinking living in the city due to shootings, chronic theft, assault, open drug sales, and drug use, and inadequate police coverage. Please remember that if public safety continues to erode, downtown will spiral downhill, losing residents, businesses, and visitors. Continued efforts to defund or abolish the police will only serve to destroy the core of the city.
Restaurants, as you all know, have been very hard hit by this pandemic. We're also being impacted severely by the crime and homelessness crises that also are plaguing us at the moment. For the safety of our team members in particular, our guests and friends that want to come from outlying areas to visit our city, we really urge a focus on reducing crime.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, a few more people that sounded on that note. I did hear a couple of people come out and really advocate for the full expansion of the LEAD program, which still has yet to happen. It's not citywide.
What does that do?
The LEAD program is the diversion program, law enforcement assisted diversion, but it's not just law enforcement anymore. They have just, you know, regular folks who can recommend that someone in crisis go through that program. Mm-hmm. And it's
never worked.
Was
there any common ground between the first group of people you played and the second group of people you played? Because it seems to me that if you want to implement these fairly expensive, you know, climate change programs, you have to have a really healthy downtown, which is spinning off lots of sales tax revenue, don't you?
Right, right, for sure. And I think the common ground, certainly it's virtual, so you didn't see anybody chit-chatting or getting together, but I think that they overlapped in the need for funding for housing and for addressing the homelessness situation. You know, you didn't hear, like in previous years, I've heard people come in and advocate for, you know, lock people up, criminalize kind of homelessness kind of arguments from some folks living in Seattle. You don't hear anything like that. You hear very compassion Seattle kind of flavored stuff coming from those who are asking for more focus on public safety. Another thing I want to point out, you heard a couple of people mention the people's budget, the solidarity budget. So the people's budget is what Shama Sawant puts out every budget year. Mm-hmm. It's got, you know, Shama Sawant type priorities in it. The solidarity budget is something new, or sort of new. It's a kind of a, it's all of those groups we heard last year at last year's budget process with the protests going on and calls for the end of systemic racism and defunding the police. It's almost every group that was ever involved in that. And then some, more than 100 groups, I think, involved, who are calling for almost identically some of the stuff we heard last year, including a 50% cut from the Seattle Police Department.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody's seriously considering that, are they?
I don't know that I would say that. There's at least there's a couple of council members.
Well, I mean,
sure.
The idea is you're going to cut that and substitute lay people with special talents, I guess, for conflict resolution. Is that it? But I mean, there's no team like that actually put together, is there?
No. So you hear, from some on the council who would be ready, who are already upset that it didn't happen last year, right? Mm-hmm. So you have kind of your Shama Sawant, Tammy Morales, who think that it could happen now. And then you'll have your Andrew Lewis, Dan Strauss, who think it's going to be a minute before we get all of these new kind of groups that we're talking about with mental health and different organizations out to do this outreach, that kind of stuff. It's going to be a bit before we get that. And it's going to be a minute before we have all the affordable housing, the permanent supportive housing up and ready. In the meantime, we have to do something else, which means you have to have the cops on the street.
Right. William, is there any progress in that area? Any city that's doing that where we could look to say, oh, yeah, this works, or, oh, no, it doesn't work, it's hopelessly idealistic?
There's kind of pick and choose programs from various jurisdictions, but not one city who's got it all figured out. Although I got a voicemail the other day from someone asking me whether or not the Seattle City Council had looked at the Denver model, which I'm not actually familiar with. But he lives here in Seattle and he had just gone to Denver and said their streets are awesome and he would like ours to look like that.
That's like street ambassadors, right?
I think so. I believe so. Which is like a community. So that's community service officers kind of a thing, which I know the mayor's budget proposal does, expand that quite a bit.
All right, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It is time now for the Daily Dose of Kindness. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird and Company Incorporated. Some of London's iconic red buses are getting a makeover in order to help the homeless, and the new project could be coming to parts of the U.S. CBS's Tina Krause is in London with the story.
London's famous red buses roll right by hundreds of homeless people on the streets of the British capital.
One, two, three.
But a new campaign invites those in need to step on board.
Providing everything from access to a doctor, a dentist, showers, haircuts.
Three buses have been remodeled, complete with laptops to help the homeless find jobs and open bank accounts. American ex-convict Thomas Noble is now off the streets.
I've been broken from front to back and up and down, and it's been bad.
He found a job with a British charity that trains homeless people as baristas. Money raised from the Change Please program is paying for these bus services.
You've got to try and make the space as nice as you can and really try and connect with people.
The buses will run 6 days a week over the next 2 years, each one helping at least six homeless people every day.
There will be no judgment. You step on that bus, they got you.
People can send a text to request a bus to stop by them. Organizers say the drive for change is transforming lives.
We leave someone with a before and after photo and a little Polaroid.
A small token for people like Thomas to remember just how far they've come. Tina Krause, CBS News, London.
From the G and Ursula Show, which begins at 9 o'clock here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. The NBA survived the pre-vaccination stage of the pandemic by playing in a bubble. But now that the vaccines are available to anybody, they seem to have a bigger problem. So I've only read a little bit about the Kyrie Irving case. What's his argument?
Yeah. Right now, the current argument, and this is new over the last at least 24 hours, the current argument is the reason why he doesn't want to get the vaccine is because he wants to fight for others. And when I say fight for others, he wants to be the reason that people that don't want to get the vaccine. And so he kind of wants to fight for them having to get it. He doesn't think that people should have to get the vaccine. So that's kind of his fight for why he doesn't want to get the vaccine. Now, the Nets, who at first were saying, okay, hopefully Kyrie will get vaccinated and hopefully that he'll be able to play in New York because they have rules right now where you have to be vaccinated in order to play. And then maybe he's just going to be missing the home games and then he'll be able to play on the away games. Now the Nets are saying, you know what? If Kyrie's not vaccinated, he's not playing. And that's players.
Now, is the bubble thing over? I mean, are they still in the bubble or not?
No.
They're not in the bubble. So there's a chance that he could get infected. I mean, this is the thing. We're focusing on this mandate, but it sounds to me like the team has made a judgment that they don't want to risk somebody becoming a super spreader in the clubhouse.
That's where it is. And you know, just now, just recently, over the yesterday, we saw the article that just came out about the parents now in Wisconsin that are going to be suing because their kid got caught COVID. And so we kind of wonder what's going to happen with those kind of cases going forward. And I think it's the same thing with Cam Newton. Cam Newton, who was the quarterback for the New England Patriots, and we know that he got cut at the beginning of the season. I actually believe that the reason why he got cut was because of how he kept choosing to not get vaccinated. And I think the New England Patriots was like, we didn't want our quarterback doing that. So Kyrie Irving right now, we'll wait and see. Me and a few of my friends in the text threads, we all predict that he is going to get vaccinated because, again, I've been saying it for some time now, talk is cheap. But actions are expensive. There's a lot of people that sit there and say what they're not going to do. But when you lose your job and lose your money and have to go home to your family and say, hey, kids, family, just want to let you guys know it's going to be a rough Christmas this year. And oh, and by the way, I can't get unemployment. So I won't be bringing on any money. So I think Kyrie Irving will end up getting the vaccine. But we'll see.
What's his salary?
He doesn't make that much. I mean, oh, he doesn't? Like 30-something million or something like that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Not that much.
Most people, you make that for 1 year, you put in a decent stock fund, you don't need to work anymore.
Yeah, you know, yeah, okay. I mean, wait, don't you make more than that, Dave?
No comment. Let's talk about the Kraken game. What, did you watch the Kraken game?
Okay, yes. It's 7:15. First of all, I watched the game before, and I was like, wait a minute. This hockey seems pretty cool. And then I start seeing all of the intros and all of the things going on, and they turn the lights off. And my buddy KJ Wright was at the game as well. And he's like, gee, this is kind of cool out here. I'm like, wow. And so I'm excited. And I'm okay. Oh, it's action. And I will say, I started off with a little bit more energy, right? Like, okay, this is a Seattle Kraken representing. There was two problems I had. One, I don't know the rules. Mm-hmm. Two, I don't know of any players. So that was kind of weird, right? I can't remember watching a sporting event in which I didn't know any of the players and the rules. So that kind of made things rough. Now, so the end of the first period, and I was like, oh, man. So I saw them leave their bench, and they go into, I said, oh, first period, I thought it was four periods, right? No. So this is what I'm thinking. No, hear me out. Okay. I thought it was four periods. And so I saw and I said, oh, so this must be halftime. So I left from my couch up to my bed to go upstairs. And I'm like, okay, I'll watch the second half, which I'm thinking is the second half. Mm-hmm. I watch the second half when I get up there. And so when I get up to my bed, I turn on the TV and I'm like, wait a minute. They're out there already. And so, wait, there is four periods. And then like 5 minutes later, I hit the bed. I fell asleep. And so I missed the first goal for the Kraken. It seems like it was a good game. The final score was 3-2. And then they lost. Last thing I want to say is this. I don't know if I really want to get invested yet. And here's why. Look, man, right now the Seahawks are struggling. You know, they had a little rough one, and Russell Wilson is out. We know what happened with the Mariners. I just can't get too invested in too much sports right now. My heart can't take it. I need somebody to win now.
I see.
Can't be having everybody lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's understood. There's only two rules to hockey. Number one, no icing. And number two, there's three halves in every game. Just remember that, and you'll be fine.
Oh, it's three. Wait, there's three halves?
Yeah.
So wait, so what's the period thing?
Never.
First mind. Period?
It's first period, second period, and third period. You got your three halves.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Just math. Okay. Don't worry about
it. You can't have three halves of something, Dave. Half is half.
But Dave. You can't have thirds. Thirds are not a thing.
Well, it is in hockey. That's why they're called periods.
So yes or no, are there four periods?
No. There's only three.
There's three periods.
Right.
So it's not three halves.
Well, you know what I mean.
No, half I don't know what you mean.
Well, we'll talk about it later. And it's not halftime. It's called intermission. Between first and period,
that's the problem.
Period,
if you don't use halves, period. You can't call it halftime.
And then what's up with
third
the,
time?
And Sully, what's up with the power play, bro? Like I'm like,
oh,
what is going
power
on?
Play, well, that's when you play a man up when the other team gets a penalty. Yeah. They pull one guy off the ice, and you
one
play
one team
four,
gets more players
on
than the others. See, this is all stuff you're going to have to learn, G. Yeah. That takes us to 7. G is on at 9 o'clock with Ursula. Are
thanks,
you with
guys.
Ursula today?
Yeah, we're at Ursula. Okay. Thanks, bro. Appreciate you. Talk to you tomorrow.
And now, direct from the Mike Salk Show is the man it's named for, Mike Salk himself, who watched the opening regular season game of the Kraken in which they lost. But was it a good game?
Oh, it was definitely a good game. They played
decently well. I mean, I think that's a team that can play better than they played last night, and they'll definitely win some games over the course of the year. Playing Vegas in your opening night in their building, not an easy challenge for them. That's one of the better teams they'll face this year. Definitely, well, probably anyway, the best in their division. So all in all, it was an okay night for the Kraken, but they looked good. The uniforms looked good.
Good.
The chemistry was not quite there yet, which makes sense since, you know, all of these guys got thrown into the team together a couple of weeks ago and had never played with each other before. So all in all, a great first night. And then just, you know, bigger historical perspective. It was amazing. We now have a hockey team. We've got a winter sport finally here in Seattle that we can watch and get into. And, you know, I've been talking about this for years. It's one of the things that you need to really make it a world-class city. And I believe Seattle is a world-class city. It's not a sleepy little town in the Northwest anymore. And if you want to be a world-class city, this is the type of thing you need.
Does the crowd play a role in the game?
Yeah, I think they can provide a little momentum. I don't know whether, you know, it's as big a role as it can in football where you can legitimately affect their ability to communicate. But, you know, I think being on the road can be hard. You know, traveling, especially with COVID and all that, I think it can travel probably plays a bigger role right now than the crowd.
Now, you're originally from Boston, which has had a long hockey history. It's the Bruins, I think
it is one of the original six teams. Yes.
Yeah. Right. So, and I forced myself because I'm really not that interested in the fine points of, frankly, any game, but I forced myself to read the hockey primer in the Seattle Times to try to understand the blue lines and the offsides and onsides. Do you think Seattle fans are sufficiently prepped for that?
No, not really, but I don't think you ever can be. Like, I think you've got to read it. What I tell people who ask me, like, what do I need to do? Will you explain hockey to me? And I usually say, no, I won't. I never played the game at any great level, really at any level. So I'm not the person to explain the game to you. I've been a fan since I was little. The first game I ever went to was a pro hockey game. So I've loved hockey my whole life. What I tell people is learn offsides and icing. Mm-hmm. Once you understand the concept behind those two things, the entire rest of the game will make sense. Because the whole game is built around offsides. How do you get over the other team's blue line and into the offensive zone with the puck going in before you? And that essentially is the way defense is played. It's all played around the idea of offsides. And once it's sent into the offensive zone, the defense is trying to get the puck out of it again without shooting it the length of the ice, which becomes icing and brings it back to your end. Does that make sense?
I did try to understand icing. That's where the puck crosses the center line before a player.
It goes all the way to the goal line. It goes from behind the center line all the way to the other end without touching a player. That is considered icing, and they bring it all the way back to in front of your goal.
I mean, it's a little like foosball, right?
It's not unlike foosball, only the players can move laterally and not just spin around in circles.
Well, I understand that. Yes, I got that much. So are there traditions that the crowd needs to know? For example, I've gone to some of the what are they, AAA games, mm-hmm. whatever it is
now. WHL games here?
Yeah, right. Where they, you know, they throw stuff into the crowd and the crowd throws stuff onto the ice. Does that happen?
Well, the one thing you'll want to think about throwing onto the ice is a hat. And you would only do that if a player scores 3 goals himself in a game. That's called a hat trick.
Because that's a hat trick.
There you go. And when someone scores a hat trick, you take your hat off, if you're so inclined, and throw it onto the ice. And they have a delay for a couple of minutes while the gang comes out and, you know, picks everything up with a shovel and throws it into a bucket and the crowd goes wild. And so there is some hat throwing. Hopefully you have a soft hat so it doesn't hurt anybody when it comes hurtling to the ice.
And a cheap hat because you're not going to get it.
Right. You don't want a brand new $30 Kraken hat. You don't want to just throw onto the ice. So maybe bring an extra hat with you if you're worried about the whole hat issue. Traditions, though, are hockey's built on tradition. It is a game. We talked to John Buchagross yesterday. He was the play-by-play announcer last night for ESPN. And he had a great line that hockey is built on sacrifice. Hmm. Part of it is because you sacrifice a lot to make it. It's not a cheap sport to play. You have to get the pads and skates and sticks and all that stuff costs money. And it's hard to get rinks, so parents end up driving their kids all over, and they do it at godforsaken times of the morning that only you and I as morning hosts truly understand. The only people I know who wake up at 4 a.m. in Boston are hockey dads, and they take their kids everywhere, and they know a shortcut to get to everywhere, and they know the Dunkin' Donuts outside every rink. And so there's a lot of sacrifice made to get there. And then once you play the game, there's even more sacrifice because oftentimes you get hit with 100-mile-an-hour pucks on purpose. You dive in front of them and you take and absorb checks, body checks, physical hits in order to move the puck forward. So hockey is a game built on sacrifice. And because of that, you get incredibly tough guys playing the sport. And they do it with great reverence for the game that they play. And it generally makes for an incredible fan experience.
So it's not just a sport, it's a lifestyle.
I would agree with that. I think that's true. There is a bit of a hockey lifestyle. And the guys, you know, there's a lot of traditions around winning the Stanley Cup, the most famous trophy in all of sports. And they won't touch it or be photographed with it until they've won it. And when they do win it, there's an order who gets to touch it. First the captain, then the most veteran player. And then they have their own order of who gets to touch it. And then in the offseason, everyone who won it gets a chance to spend a whole day with it doing whatever they want with it. So, yeah, hockey's got a lot. You're right. It is a culture, not just a sport.
And there are standout players, but are there? Does each team have a franchise player the way that football seems to?
There's nothing quite like the quarterback, really, in any sport, right? I guess basketball has it because you've got to have that one great player to win in basketball. But yeah, you may have, you know, the captain is sort of stands in for that, and you know, fitting with what I just said, the captain is a huge honor. In hockey, it does have like there's a real world implication, which means he's the only person who's allowed to talk to the referee. And if he's not on the ice, you'll see people wearing an A instead of a C on their shirt. They're the alternate captains. They can stand in for the captain if he's on the bench. So there's a real implication for it. But to be a captain of a hockey team means something. It's an incredible honor, and the guys treat it with reverence, and there's a lot of leadership that goes with it. And usually you've got to be in the league for a while and really earn that C. Sometimes it's not the best player on the team, but it is the person who commands that respect in the dressing room.
Okay. First home game is,
it's I think a week from Saturday, the 23rd.
All right. After which Seattle has changed forever.
That's right.
Mike Sauk, Mike Sauk Show. Thank you, Mike.
Of course, Dave. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.